violence gripping Lebanon's capital, multiple casualties at a protest against a probe into last year's Beirut blast. We have the details for you just ahead. Bulldozing Palestinian property, Israeli forces destroy dozens of structures north of the occupied city of Al-Quds. And Japan dissolves its parliament, setting the stage for an early election at the end of the month. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. We begin with Lebanon's capital, where protests against a judge investigating last year's catastrophic Beirut port explosion has turned deadly. So far, at least 6 people are dead and 60 others have been wounded. Heavy gunfire and blasts have been heard. There have also been reports of a sniper shooting at people. Army troops have moved to clear the protest site. The protesters are outraged at what they see as Washington's interference in the investigation. They say the judge overseeing the case is being swayed by the United States. Resistance movement Hezbollah is critical of the U.S. interference. The movement is calling on the army to intervene and stop armed groups from shooting at protesters. Prime Minister Najib Mirati also wants those responsible for the violence to be swiftly arrested. Our correspondent Mariam Saleh is joining us now from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, with more on the developing story. Mariam, what details do you have to share with us and our viewers right now?
Well, we managed to make it, despite the sniper fire and the continuous fire that you hear, to make it to this area, which is closest possible to where we saw the first fire against the peaceful protesters. This is the area of Tayuni. This is the Tayuni roundabout that is well known, and perhaps the cameraman could give you a closer shot at those buildings that are facing us right now. The first sniper was seen in one of those high buildings, and he directly fired at the protesters that were gathering in order to walk towards the Justice Palace, only several meters away. And the most of the fire was on the heads of the protesters. Those protesters, we have, as we know right now, at least 3 who have been killed, 3 martyrs. One of them was a lady who was living, a resident of one of the buildings in this area, who was shot at directly in her home. And she is also known, she is also a martyr, so we have at least 3 confirmed cases. The others are considered in a critical situation with sustaining heavy wounds. Now, of course, this all began, like we said, we had a peaceful protest with walking from one area to the other, and still we saw that the sniper fire came haphazardly, suddenly. We just heard the sniper fire, and that began when we were gathered in the area of the Justice Palace. During that time, of course, there were protesters in the Justice Palace. In that area, there were civilians, and there were also experts at law. They were protesting to the media. Those lawyers were going to enter the court to talk and given their lawsuit against the judge Tariq Bitar because of this issue of the probe of the Beirut port explosion. And that was when we heard the sniper fire. You can hear it right now, still ongoing. When we heard that sniper fire, of course, that protest was dispersed. However, the people did give in their protest. They did speak to the media about their opinion concerning this protest. Now, what we know so far is that the fire is coming from one side specifically, and that the Lebanese army is trying to stop that fire. They have, as we know, allegedly arrested one of the snipers in one of the buildings. It's not clear, but the identity of the of this sniper. But there are many others. We're still hearing sniper fire right now. Not only fire guns, but also medium fire machines. We can hear those bombs going against the Lebanese army. The Lebanese army has also stressed in its statement that the peaceful protesters were walking unarmed to the area of the protest, which is still far away from where they started with the sniper fire. And this is what we have so far concerning that issue. We do still have sniper fire in that area. Now, concerning politically, the political issues related to that, we have a statement, an official statement by Hezbollah and the Amal movement, the two main allies that are being targeted by this bomb blast, despite the fact that the judge, Saad Bitar, did not send a summoning of any of the ministers of Hezbollah, it seemed, because none of them were specialized in the area of the port. However, we know from the sides that are allied with the United States, they were talking about an indictment against Hezbollah, the resistance movement specifically, by Tariq Jajbi Petard, which would be ultimately the result of his probe, his politicized probe, as they have called it. Now, let me tell you about the statement about the incident today specifically. Hezbollah and the Amal movement, in their statement, they said that at 10:45 a.m. Beirut time this morning, and while the participants in the peaceful protest were on their way to the Justice Department to protest against and denounce the politicization of the probe into the Beirut port explosion. And when they reached the area of Tayuni, which is right behind me right now, they were under fire directly by snipers who shot them directly in the head. The snipers were on top of the buildings that are facing the roundabout of Tayuni, and that also led to heavy fire against the protesters who were shot, like we said, directly in the head. Now, Hezbollah and the Amal movement consider this aggression from a group of armed, organized group. They believe that this only this ultimately is only to take the country to a sedition, to a new preemptive method to try to take the country to a to sow sedition among the people, and that with only the only side that bears responsibility are those that are inciting this violence, and those groups that are hiding behind the blood of the martyrs and the victims of the Beirut port explosion in order to be able to make political gains. And of course, Hezbollah and the Amal movement called the Lebanese army to bear full responsibility, to intervene swiftly to stop those criminals and their political groups and from their from this plot. And they also called on Hezbollah supporters, the Amal movement supporters, and those who are organized members of the political groups to be calm, to show self-restraint, and to not be taken by this heinous plot in order to take the country to a civil war. Now, that was the statement of Hezbollah and the Amal movement. We have a statement by the Lebanese army, which also said in its statement, and this is the result of its, of course, witnessing, and that is, of course, a very clear position from the Lebanese army, that the protesters were unarmed and they were shot at by snipers in the buildings on top of the rooftops of the buildings. This issue could probably escalate, as many people are saying. However, when you have statements from Hezbollah calling for calm and self-restraint, saying they will not be provoked, they will not be taken to a civil war, any sort of civil violence, this means that the issue could be contained. We are waiting to see what is going to happen, if the army can contain that group, if they do get people into custody to know who is behind this group. Now, we know from the statement, although of Hezbollah and the Amal movement did not clearly accuse any side, but we know from experts, from analysts, that the main side that is accused right now is the Lebanese forces militia. It can clearly be considered a militia. They consider it some political group, but it is a militia as long as it is armed. We have reports also from one of the members of parliament in the Lebanese forces who clearly confessed that or admitted that they the Lebanese forces is being armed and trained by the United States. And we have, of course, continuous meetings between the U.S. ambassador and the Lebanese forces, militia here in Lebanon. And so this could probably mean that the U.S. has decided to take part and launch or try to sow a certain sedition in Lebanon to create a new civil war in the country.
Thanks a lot, Mariam Saleh, joining us from the Lebanese capital. Well, author and researcher Ali Hamia says The current instability in Lebanon only works to the advantage of the U.S. and Israel.
We have our enemy in, you know, at our southern front. And this enemy is supported by United States and some of the inside traitor, as we say. We are resistant in all our means just to keep Lebanon stable and, you know, to defend all our means, by all our means, defending the Lebanese and the territories and the sea borders. But the American conspiracy is not letting us, you know, to do our job. Every time we try to stable our country, we have something coming up by the American. The American and the Israelis are the only side that are benefiting from Lebanon going into sectarian strife or into chaos or violence, whatever, just to not let this government work.
Israel keeps destroying and seizing more Palestinian property in the occupied West Bank. 30 commercial facilities, including a gas station, have now been demolished. The demolitions took place near the Ghanadiya checkpoint north of Al-Quds. Israel is planning to build a tunnel linking a highway to one of its settlements in the area. It also wants to build a new settlement there. All Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. Israel regularly demolishes Palestinian homes, claiming they lack building permits. A UN report says in August alone, nearly 100 Palestinians were displaced when their homes were destroyed in Al-Quds. Now, staying with the occupied West Bank, that's not the only aggression targeting the Palestinian population there. Israeli forces have also fatally shot a young man in the early morning hours. Palestinian media say the incident took place at Ghanadiya checkpoint in southern Ramallah on Thursday. The victim's identity is not known yet. Regime forces claim they shot the Palestinian driver because he ran over an Israeli soldier. In recent weeks, Israeli forces have killed several Palestinians during raids in a number of West Bank towns. Palestine's Al-Quds Brigades, that's the armed wing of the Islamic Jihad movement, says it's on alert and fully ready to defend Palestinians locked up in Israeli jails. The brigades has even declared a state of mobilization. The movement says it will not shy away from going to war with the Israeli regime to defend the prisoners. Hamas official Zahir Jabarin also says prisoners from all factions and resistance groups are ready to join any coordinated measures. Israel has been treating inmates harshly since last month when six Palestinians escaped a top security jail. They were later recaptured. 400 prisoners are now on hunger strike in protest at the tough conditions. Japan is getting ready to hold its snap elections at the end of this month. It's been only days since Fumio Kishida became Japan's new prime minister. He's now dissolved the lower house of parliament in preparation for the vote. The vote will pit Kishida's party leading in early polls against main opposition, the Constitutional Democratic Party. For voters, the coronavirus pandemic, economy, and employment are the main concerns. Kishida has promised to improve the government's COVID-19 response, promote economic growth, and increase Japan's defense potential. The former administration faced a lot of criticism over its management of the coronavirus crisis and the holding of the Summer Olympics in Tokyo despite the pandemic. I'm going to go back to one of our previous stories where Israel keeps destroying and seizing more Palestinian property in the occupied West Bank. 30 commercial facilities, including a gas station, have now been demolished. Palestinian activist and human rights advocate Amal Wahdan joins us now from Ramallah. Ms. Wahdan, welcome to the program. Give us your thoughts on this continued land grab and home and property demolition that's being carried out by the Israelis. It's not only stopping, but it seems to be gaining more steam and more momentum as each day passes by.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for having me. What's going on in occupied Jerusalem cannot be separated from what's going on in all of Palestine and in the region as a whole. Actually, the Zionist establishment is being unleashed in its massive occupied demolition of houses and workshops and agricultural facilities has been going on for several years, but it is intensifying in this particular time. It seems like they are in a hurry to grab the rest of what's left from East, from occupied Jerusalem, to declare a de facto capital for their claimed Jewish state. So with giving with a variety of false pretexts on the demolition of these homes and houses and workshops and agricultural facilities, it's not actually it's not actually going to stop unless there is an action be done to confront it. That demolition of the houses, they want to clear more and more space for their settlements. Now they are thinking of separating Bethlehem from Jerusalem, from occupied Jerusalem, by another settlement in the in between. Actually, the assaults that is happening and continue to happen in Sheikh Jarrah, Silwan, and the registration and settlements of properties and land in occupied Jerusalem is another actually crime. What is left over for Arab Palestinians in occupied Jerusalem is only 13%. And by the end of this year, the, what they call the Jerusalem minister in their government has promised that he will finish 50% of this settlement plan, and it will continue. This is all happening, backed up by the U.S. and the NATO countries, and by a close eye from the international public opinion. What we need actually is a real plan on the ground that cannot leave Israel unleashed, and the resistance has to say its word actually at this very important moment. We call the Jerusalem battle the battle of all battles. If we don't move really fast here in the occupied territories, in Jerusalem, occupied Jerusalem, and resistance camps, really we are endangering Jerusalem. And the latest court decision of allowing the settlers, the Zionist settlers who came from New York and other parts of the world to make their silent prayer is only one step towards dividing Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Thanks a lot. Amal Watan, Palestinian activist and human rights advocate, speaking to us from Ramallah. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Darkery View.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing the Netflix documentary Get Me Roger Stone, directed by Dylan Bank, Daniel DeMauro, and Morgan Penny. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the vice chair of the London Film Critics Circle and chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Zach Cochran, who is an anti-racist activist with the campaign group Stand Up to Racism. Now, Get Me Roger Stone explores the life and career of the American political strategist Roger Stone, who is known as the dark mastermind behind Donald Trump's presidential campaign and is arguably responsible for putting him in the White House. Stone is a self-proclaimed dirty trickster, and this documentary exposes Stone as a man who knows no bounds when it comes to winning in politics.
The game, he has fun with it, and he's very good at it.
I'm an agent provocateur.
Political strategist,
controversial as you can get.
An incredible capacity for treachery.
Win at all cost mentality.
When people think of Washington corruption, they think of Roger Stone.
Those who say I have no soul, those who say I have no principles, are losers. Those are bitter losers.
There's really nobody quite like Roger Stone.
The Nixon tattoo is really all you need to know about Roger.
We really pioneered negative campaign advertising.
He created the modern sleazeball lobbyist.
Washington's been worse for it ever since.
Stone's rule: it is better to be infamous than never be famous at all. He
got chased out of Washington.
He's looking to see if he can find an angle.
I was like a jockey looking for a horse. You can't win the race if you don't have a horse.
Roger saw something that nobody else saw back in the early 80s.
I suggested that Trump should explore a bid for the presidency.
He created Donald Trump as a political figure.
You're the biggest lie, loser!
What have I lied about?
Have you spoken with the WikiLeaks founder?
You're a rape tonight.
Roger, you can't just say that.
You have to be outrageous to get noticed.
I revel in your hatred. Because if I weren't effective, you wouldn't hate me.
First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Get Me, Roger Stone?
Well, the trailer really gets the tone of the film. It's done in this kind of lively, jaunty, comedic tone. But the material is just bone-chilling. It's absolutely horrifying to watch it, especially as it goes back kind of 40 years in the past, 50 years even, to him working with Nixon and Reagan and Bush and, I mean, basically all the kind of slightly shady campaigns that have gone on over the years.
It is surprisingly funny, as you say.
But it's done with this kind of sense of humor, kind of because he's so unapologetic about it. He just doesn't make any bones about it. He talks about using lies and deception in all of his work and how he's very proud of doing that. And it's pretty horrifying. And also the fact that he's been working with Trump since the early 80s, which I didn't know that before, and I'd heard of him. I mean, he's been in the news, but I didn't know that he's been basically grooming Trump to be president since he met him, because he thought, oh, this is quite a quirky character that the people seem to love. Maybe he'd be a good one. Oh, so it just gave me the chills.
And what about you, Zach? What was your take on Get Me, Roger Stone, and had you heard of him before?
I've never heard of Roger Stone, but absolutely very watchable program. For many people, with Trump's election, it sent shocks around the world. So to actually get some insight into how Donald Trump could have been elected, I think was very, very interesting. And to see, as Richard just said, that over four decades now, Roger Stone has not only been grooming guys like Donald Trump, but been involved in countless campaigns, but also we hear about the power of US lobbying firms, but to see one of the guys who was instrumental in this kind of sleazeball politics and how he unapologetically promoted that was very, very interesting, yeah.
I think the character you're talking about is Paul Manafort, and we're going to dissect his character a bit later on. But I must say, I think we can all agree that when Donald Trump won the presidency, it took nearly everyone by surprise, and many thought it was merely a publicity stunt. But after watching this documentary, you get a sense that there is, in fact, a method behind all the madness. And did you get that feeling as well, Rich?
Well, yeah, there's definitely this sense that, I mean, Roger Stone claims he's just an agent provocateur. All he wants to do is shake up the system. He doesn't care about helping people, so he doesn't have any of those political values that you would think a political leader should have. He just wants to shake things up. So Trump is his perfect candidate, and you can see how he honed his skills through Nixon and Reagan and Bush, and then it all pays off for him and Trump, which means that we all pay for it. It's a pretty frightening depiction of the way that this thing unfolded over all these years. You kind of think of Trump as being a fairly recent thing because he's only emerged on the scene in the last year or two as a serious candidate, but actually this has been in the works. So.
Years in the making.
Yeah.
In 1987, I suggested that Trump should explore a bid for the presidency.
This sounds like political presidential talk to me, and I know people have talked to you about whether or not you want to run. Would you ever?
Probably not, but I do get tired of seeing what's happening with this country, and if it got so bad, I would never want to rule it out totally, because I really am tired of seeing what's happening with this country.
I was like a jockey looking for a horse. You can't win the race if you don't have a horse. I interceded with the Portsmouth, New Hampshire Chamber of Commerce to arrange a lunch. Helicopter landing was as big a news as his speech. This is kind of the first time I saw the power of Trump. The public interest in Trump was palpable. It was like electric. And he lit the place on fire.
That comment, I was a jockey looking for a horse. I mean, as despicable of a character Stone is, he is quite funny. You have to give him that at least. And Rich, Stone takes a lot of credit for putting Trump in the White House. What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, he basically created Trump as a political figure, and you hear Stone use all the words that Trump uses in his speeches. So you realize that Roger Stone has been feeding him all of these lines, all of these famous lines that we think of Trump as saying, originated in Roger Stone. And the film also kind of documents the whole kind of shady political situation where Stone was part of the campaign, then dropped out of the campaign, but really didn't. That was just a public ruse, and then kind of secretly was still running things. And it's all very dodgy, but Stone is just totally unapologetic about all of it. He just admits the whole thing. He admits that it's a big ruse. It's a trick to trick the voters into voting for someone like this.
He is famous for being infamous.
Yeah.
And Zach, I want to bring you in here because you're with the Stand Up to Racism, and you've organized numerous protests against Donald Trump when he was inaugurated and the Muslim ban. And surely you protest not just Donald Trump as an individual, but people like Roger Stone and what they stand for.
Absolutely. This what was so useful about this film was to get an insight into the kind of politics that were pushing Donald Trump. And I actually want to say, this process, what became clear from the film, goes back to Nixon. Actually, Nixon came to power in 1968. There was a book at the time by one of his advisors, Kevin Phillips, that talked about the emerging Republican majority, about channeling the voters' resentment, and that largely played out in turning the economic insecurities of white Americans into resentments towards black. It was a key strategy of Nixon, and we see this through the film. When they talk about racist coding, the language is being used, pushed through a number of candidates, but particularly with Donald Trump, we see the appalling election campaign. He ran the Muslim ban, the scapegoating of Mexicans, saying he would build a wall with Mexico. It's clear that Roger Stone was absolutely instrumental in encouraging Trump to go down this racist rhetoric, which I had wider ramifications.
Well, and the whole birther movement, which was Roger Stone created that whole thing about Donald Trump chasing Obama for his birth certificate was a Roger Stone create. That was his little, and that was a racist campaign that was playing into the hands of those right wing people who have those views, who don't feel like they can express them and feel marginalized, and it's all about manipulating the people, isn't it?
So are you saying that Stone is actually as influential as he makes out to be in the world of politics?
I think he's very influential. I'm not convinced that he's actually racist. I think he's manipulating people's opinions and people's, you know, the way people feel. But he is very influential, mm-hmm. quite clearly.
Unfortunately so. And Zach, Stone says in the documentary that Stone says that Trump is sort of this anti-establishment figure. And how is it that people perceive him to be this way, and is it accurate?
I think what we absolutely have to say, and it was brought out in the film, Trump was able to fill a vacuum. We've seen, not just in America, but a number of countries, a hollowing out of politics. The establishment has been deep dissatisfaction with years of neoliberal policies, and Trump was able to come in and channel that anti-establishment sentiment, not by offering people policies, redistribution of wealth, but by encouraging people to draw conclusions like scapegoating the Muslim community and migrant communities as well.
Mm-hmm. And in the documentary, Roger says that, someone who's interviewed says about Roger that he understands democracy and that democracy is appealing to the process of the majority. How accurate is this, and what do you make this claim in the film, that Stone understands democracy?
Well, yeah, obviously, because he's appealing to these opinions that are unvoiced, and so he's tapping into the majority of people, the way that they feel, and which is kind of horrifying.
And does Trump represent the majority of America?
No, I think absolutely not. If you look at this, this is the such a worrying thing. His policies, wants to cut corporation tax to record lows, roll back on initiatives to tackle climate change, things that do not benefit ordinary Americans. No, the population, we're the richest country in the world, yet a quarter of the population live in poverty, and this is a billionaire. But it's absolutely by scapegoating, deflecting blame at the establishment. It's a bogus anti-establishment. What we see very clearly from this film, Stone, his close advisor, has been involved with Manafort, who we're going to come on to.
Actually, I'm glad you brought him up, because we're about to go to him just now. So we'll just pause there for now.
Trump asked me to get involved because my reputation, among other things in politics, is understanding of the convention process, the delegate process, and most of the major successful big conventions over the last 30 years I've been intimately involved in.
Did Roger recommend you for the job?
Roger was one of the two or three people who strongly recommended me, yes.
Is it a surprise that Paul Manafort wound up as the campaign chairman for Trump? No, of course not. That was engineered by Roger as a way to get Corey Lewandowski bounced out of the campaign. It took a couple months, but they did it. Roger has had a guiding hand in all of this. Now, Trump is hard to guide. He spits the bit out, but Roger's had as much influence on the campaign as anyone.
I think the campaign's been professionalized. Manafort's doing a phenomenal job. I think he instills confidence in the campaign that they didn't have before.
Did you give any reporters background on Lewandowski?
No.
Okay, so do you sort of...
Roger is not an official part of the campaign.
Did he bring you in?
No.
You were just talking about Paul Manafort and how much of a shady character he is. And considering his relationship with dictators, his role in lobbying, what contribution did he make to Donald Trump's campaign team?
It was clear when Roger Stone was fired, with the knife being fired, the fact Manafort suggests that Stone recommended him and was absolutely crucial in using some of those dirty tactics to get Donald Trump elected. It shows just how bogus this idea of Trump being anti-establishment is, because Manafort's been involved with countless presidents over the decades and played the same role.
And Rich, why is it that Paul Manafort, we know that he has a relationship with Roger Stone, but denies him being involved in the campaign? I mean, is this all part of the plan? What is going on here?
I just think it's part of the way that they present one thing to the public and they talk about something. I mean, all through this film, they're talking to the cameras, because the cameras are following these people all over the place. They say one thing to the camera, then it cuts to a statement like that where Paul Manafort's on television saying exactly the opposite. So they very carefully script what they say in public, and they don't care that it's not the truth. It's all about creating this image that gets them where they want to go, and they don't really care about what they have to do to get there.
And isn't that disturbing, Zach, that these politicians are lying through their teeth? Don't they think that people can see right through this and hold them to account?
They've had many decades of perfecting the strategy. It's interesting that the film starts with Roger Stone talking about as a kid in the school canteen in a mock election, where he, at the time, ironically, is back in JFK, and he tells all the other kids that Nixon will make you go to school on Saturday to win this mock election. He said that he learned there the value of disinformation, and we've seen this process throughout his political career, and it is very worrying. It makes a mockery of democracy and allows them to distort politics in the interests of those at the top.
Mm. And Rich, we know that Roger Stone is dubbed as the political dirty trickster. What examples do we see in the documentary of his other stunts?
Well, I mean, all of the stuff, all of the crooked Hillary stuff, you know, just suddenly creating this huge cloud of suspicion around the Clintons, around Obama, just everything that kind of, it's just this huge cloud of misinformation that just goes around, and everybody starts to wonder, well, what's the truth? And it's very hard to pick the truth out of it, especially if you're leaning toward that angle. He talks very openly about the fact that he doesn't believe in any of the political points of the Republican Party.
He identifies as a libertarian, he says.
Yeah, and he says he doesn't believe in their any of their policies. And yet he put a Republican in the White House, and he doesn't care.
And what does Stone get out of all of this?
I don't know. Yeah? Do you think he just enjoys the power of disrupting the system? He just seems like a pure disruptor, doesn't he?
Absolutely. One thing I'll say, I suppose, in terms of his libertarian leanings, I think going back to Nixon, if you look at the 1960s at the time in rising struggles, particularly the civil rights movement, Nixon was the kind of block against that. It's why he's got so much respect for Nixon. I think he's very much...
He has a big tattoo of Nixon on his back.
Yes.
And he flashes that throughout the documentary.
He does, and I think going back to the question of racism, I think it's why it becomes such a key issue. Haldeman, who was the chief of staff under Nixon, wrote in one of his diaries, Nixon said, the problem was essentially the blacks. And what he meant by that was black struggle became the nexus for other social struggles. It was leading to concessions being won, social reforms on the system. So he knew that... drawing back the civil rights struggles and the black struggles was absolutely crucial. That's why I think racism has played such a key role in some of his tactics. As you said, he might not necessarily have massive racist leanings, but he knew it was essential to push forward this kind of libertarian model that he does agree with, which is a rolling back of state intervention.
So he knew he had to play that racism card in order to win votes, essentially. And I want to actually ask you more about that a bit later on.
Now the children's table is the adult table, and Alex Jones is, you know, passing the dinner rolls, and we're all conspiracy American now.
Even if Donald Trump loses, I still win, because the Stone brand has been front and center, and my brand of politics have finally come into their own. CNN, MSNBC, they're now the fringe. Alt-right communications, we are the mainstream.
Did Trump really believe that Obama was not born in the United States? Does Roger Stone really believe that Bill Clinton raped all these women? You know, it doesn't matter to them is more the point. For them, there are no boundaries. Anything goes. Anything that wins, fine.
If you read Roger's blog, The Stone Zone, or follow him on Twitter, it's like coming attractions for the attacks Donald Trump will be launching 2 weeks later.
It is Hillary who hires the heavy-handed pride detectives who break into these women's homes and ransack them, who threaten their children, who kill their pets.
She's married to a man who was the worst abuser of women in the history of politics. And Hillary was an enabler, and she treated these women horribly.
Roger's, you know, relationship with Trump has been so interconnected that it's hard to define what's Roger and what's Donald. While it will be clearly a Trump presidency, I think it's influenced by a Stone philosophy.
That notion of win at any cost pretty much summarizes Stone's brand of politics. And there's so much to dissect from that clip. And Rich, if we look at the mainstream media angle, Roger Stone and Donald Trump were able to discredit the media, and the media became powerless against them. How were the campaign team able to do this, and why was this so effective?
I find it just shocking that they've been able to kind of marginalize all the mainstream and bring in people like Alex Jones and Breitbart as kind of the voice of this generation. I find it just horrifying that people are going there.
Alex Jones is, of course, a famous conspiracy theorist.
Insane conspiracy theorist, like far right wing, and really frightening. I mean, the clips that you see of him are are pretty hilarious, actually, because he's just completely rabid and crazy.
The show
but,
gave that
but
would
he's part of this.
Trump.
He's
yeah.
part of this, and he's. It's again. It's this disruptive presence. It's trying to shake the system up, and create a smaller government and let people do what they want. And it's not really the Republican agenda, but they're using the Republican Party to do it. And
yeah, that is a very interesting point. And
yeah.
Zach, I want to get your thoughts on this sort of fake news era that we're in and post-truth era.
Yeah, I mean, it's very worrying. The clip with Roger Stone's where he said NBC's, the CNN, actually, they're marginalized now, the Breitbart, and the more alt-right communications. It might be a slight exaggeration, but of becoming the more mainstream news source. It's something that the author Tariq Ali called about the extreme center. It's coming into the mainstream, which is very, very concerning, because this has a ripple effects, actually. It gives a confidence to the far right. Some of the appalling attacks we saw after the Trump presidency, because the platform given to the prominent far right blogs such as Breitbart is very concerning.
And how are left-wing groups trying to combat this?
I think what was very interesting over here, and that is I forget the name of the blog in the States, but certainly over here you saw the election of Jeremy Corbyn, that social media was absolutely instrumental in that. The work of Momentum were combating the government's austerity agenda and helping to push some of Corbyn's policies forward, and it had a bigger impact in getting to young people in the general election.
So there's still some hope, I see. And I think, going back to the documentary, I think one of the funniest lines that Roger Stone says is that politics is show business for ugly people. But on a serious note, I mean, is this what politics has been reduced to now, Rich? I mean, is this merely a freak show, a circus, and not serving the best interests of the people anymore?
Well, you kind of hope that this will snap people out of it. It's like the fact that Donald Trump was elected president should make everybody stop and say, wait a minute, something's horribly wrong here. You know, the fact that Britain voted for Brexit made Britain stop. And then the next election, everybody kind of hesitated and thought, wait a minute. And the vote shifted quite dramatically because people spoke up and spoke the truth, which hadn't been spoken up during the campaign originally. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that that's what we see in America. I'm hoping that the people who just didn't speak up during the election last year will come out at the next one and kind of make the truth known and get because I think the truth has to win out in the end. Mm-hmm. It's too depressing to think that these people are going
to
win.
And I'd love to end it on that note, actually. Thank you, Richard, and thank you, Zach, for your time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Kamila Shambayati.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
Humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajil farajahum. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We want to look at human rights from the eyes of the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullahi alayhi, and how he views human rights. When it comes to human rights, you will not find a champion or a person who ever served humanity as much as the commander of the faithful Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Human rights are an integrated system, and each is indivisible as it serves the interest of people, the rights of people. But these rights vary in terms of priority and importance. One of them sometimes might be considered as a basis for the other or others. So if the foundation and the origins are lost, the structure and the branches will fall apart as well. Therefore, we want to look at Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, and how he looks at human rights. First, we will look at how he defines the right to live. Then, the right to fair equality. And then, the right to freedom. So these were the, we can say, the pillars of Imam Ali's system in trying to uphold justice on earth and trying to uphold the human rights altogether. When we look at Imam Ali alayhi salam, and when we think of him, the first thing that comes to our mind is that brave knight and his sword, Dhul-Fuqar, and his heroic battles that he conquered in order to establish the pillars of Islam and try to preach the message of Islam in order to honor the human life and in order to give the human life value. This is the first thing that comes to my and your mind when the name Ali hits it. But Amir al-Mu'mineen Salamullah Ali, he had a very indescribable, a very vast image of what humans should be and what they should have. So Amir al-Mu'mineen Salamullah Ali, in one of his most famous quotes, he says, وَتَحْسَبُ أَنَّكَ جُرْمٌ صَغِيرٌ وَفِيكَ انْطَوَى الْعَالَمُ الْأَكْبَرُ. He says, you think that you are a tiny and significant speck in this universe. However, the entire world, the entire universe is encompassed inside you. So Amir al-Mu'mineen Salamullah Ali, he brings the human being from thinking that he's so low, that he's so insignificant in this world, and he gives him all this honor and glory that the entire universe is folded inside the human being himself. So if this is how he looks at humanity, how would he describe human rights? Then the Imam Salamullah Alayhi, he goes on further to describe the human being himself and how he dignifies him. Now, before we continue, let us take a break and we come back, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Just before the break, we said Amir al-Mu'mineen Salamullah Alayhi looks at human beings as a creation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that the entire universe is folded inside him. So he is the most glorified creature of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, or creation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. There's a hadith from the Imam Salamullah Alayhi where he goes even further to decipher the human dignity from the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He says, إن الله عز وجل ركب في الملائكة عقل بلا شهوة. Allah, he created the angels with intellect without desire. And then he says he created animals with desire without intellect. And then when it comes to human beings, he says, رَكَّبَ فِي بَنِي آدَمْ كِلَيْهُمَا. When it came to the human, Allah gave him intellect and gave him desire. Then the Imam Salamullah alayhi, he tries to look at the human being from that scope. He says, he who is desire or his intellect goes over and controls his desire, he is surely better than the angels themselves. And he whose desires becomes higher and they overtake his intellect, then he is what? Worser than the animals. So the Imam Salamullah alayhi says the human beings have the capacity when it comes in terms of value to reach high and above and beyond the angels themselves, which we look at them as divine creatures. But in fact, he says that the human beings have the capacity. So first, the Imam Salamullah alayhi is trying to say that as human beings, you belong to the family that comes from Adam and Eve. And since this family exists, then it needs to have rights that exist with it, right? So it's not just a matter of left to chance. And that is the life or the right to live, the right to life. That's the first thing. Since we are a family, in the eyes of Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, then we have to make sure that the rights are preserved when it comes to us having the ability to live like anyone else. To Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, when he looks at human beings, he looks at them from the perspective of action. So one, if one has faith and has good deeds, then his level will go higher than the rest until he reaches a stage where he is above the angels themselves. Then the Imam Salamullah Ali, in another quote or another hadith or saying, he says, لَيْسَ عَلَى وَجْهِ الْأَرْضِ أَكْرَمُ عَلَى اللَّهِ مِنَ النَّفْسِ الْمُطِيعَةِ لِأَمْرِهِ. There is nothing on earth more beloved, more honored in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala than a soul that is obedient to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And obviously, in this obedience, a person who is obedient to Allah, meaning he's not observing the rights of others, he's not taking the rights of others, he's not infringing on the rights of others or the property of others. So a person becomes obedient, becomes more beloved to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala when he's upholding these rules of Allah, which is that deals with the human rights. So the Imam Salamullah alayhi, he says, a human being is the vicegerent, the leader, the representative of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on this earth. And for having such an honor, for having such, as we say, a status amongst the creations of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah has given him laws and giving him certain limitation and to-do list and not to-do list. And if a person upholds that, then he reaches that stage which Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he himself says, إِلَهِ كَفَى بِيَعْزًا أَنْ أَكُونَ لَكَ عَبْدًا. It's enough for me, it's enough honor for me that I be your slave. وَكَفَى بِفَخْرًا أَنْ تَكُونَ لِي رَبًّا. And I am honored myself to have a Lord like you. So from here, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi gives us a different look at the human being and how he should be treated. Don't think of yourself as significant, but in fact, the entire universe is folded inside you. Inshallah, we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.